ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 27th of June. I'm Nick Grimm, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The White House has blasted the US media, with Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth claiming reporters' hatred of Donald Trump has undermined the success of US strikes in Iran. A leaked intelligence report this week suggested that Iran's nuclear program had only been set back by a few months, but in a press briefing, an angry Pete Hegseth launched an attack on media outlets themselves for what he insists has been their misreporting of the true situation.
Because you, the press, because you cheer against Trump so hard, because you want him not to be successful so bad, you have to cheer against the efficacy of these strikes. You have to hope maybe they weren't effective. So let's take half-truths, spun information, leaked information, and then spin it.
The Trump administration maintains it has intelligence proving their claim US strikes really did obliterate Iran's nuclear facilities. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff revealing details of a long-term surveillance operation of one of the facilities that led to the US to develop the bunker-busting bombs they dropped on the weekend. Our America's editor, John Lyons, is in Washington. John, what did this operation involve?
Well, Nick, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, as part of the briefing at the Pentagon today, revealed that for about 15 years now, the United States has had two defense officials who have covertly been monitoring every day the Fordo nuclear facility in Iran. They've been doing everything from firstly looking at the photographs and then the construction of it. It was built over those years, the different materials used. They watched the Iranians dig it out, the construction, the weather, what was material discarded, the geology, construction materials, where those materials came from, watching the vent shaft, the exhaust shaft. Now, he didn't say whether this was from inside Iran or, more likely, was from someone remotely here in Washington, probably at the Pentagon, perhaps either with satellite surveillance or some other CCTV-type surveillance, but extraordinary. And as a result of this 15 years of surveillance, the Americans then realized the only way they could hit this facility eventually would be through this new generation of bunker buster bomb. And that's, according to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's how these bunker bombs, this generation of them, was developed.
And why is the Trump White House on the defensive over this?
They're on the defensive because the Defense Intelligence Agency of the Pentagon put out a report 2 days after the bombing of those three nuclear facilities, saying that the damage had been not that much and would only set back this program a few months. Now, the Pentagon is saying these were simply was a preliminary intelligence report. They're extremely angry that it was leaked. They're trying to track down the leaker. But now they're saying, the Trump White House is saying, the CIA and the president himself has said that, in fact, these facilities were obliterated. And so now they're trying to get all of their messages out there to say, in fact, it was much more damaged than this initial intelligence report said, trying to essentially justify what President Trump had said.
John Lyons in Washington. As Israel spent 12 days fighting Iran, in Gaza, the war there raged on, with local health authorities saying more than 800 Palestinians were killed during that period. Dozens were shot scrambling to access aid at delivery sites scattered across the strip amid severe shortages of supplies essential for survival. Doctors in Gaza are warning the crisis facing the young is getting worse by the day, with baby formula and food running desperately low. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran.
In Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza, 2-year-old Maya Al-Arja stares blankly into the distance. Her mother, Asma, watching on nearby, is fearful her daughter is wasting away.
She doesn't walk, play, smile or speak. She does nothing at all.
Maya is half the weight she should be at her age, tipping the scales at just over 6 kilograms. Asma says it's the third time her daughter's been admitted to hospital and she's making no improvement.
I'm afraid my daughter might die. She has a severe protein deficiency, her hair is falling out, her skin is peeling, and she suffers from constant diarrhea.
Other beds in the ward have children and babies suffering severe malnutrition. From toddlers to newborns, Nasser Hospital's Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah says the situation is deteriorating by the day.
The last statistic talking about 62 cases expired or died due to malnutrition. And the number of malnutrition cases increasing month by month.
Dr. Al-Farah says staff and volunteers have tried to buy milk and formula with supplies not being delivered to the hospital, but they can't afford it.
The local market now is black market. The price of milk is multiplied by 10 times.
Aid distribution inside Gaza has been chaotic ever since Israel imposed a total blockade of deliveries in March. As it partially lifted those restrictions, it allowed a private firm, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, to set up shop with the backing of the United States. But there have been regular shootings outside those sites, with dozens of Palestinians killed in recent weeks as they tried to access aid. Locals accuse Israeli forces of opening fire, and while the IDF has conceded firing warning shots at times, it's rejected blame for the mass deaths. Now the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defence Minister Israel Katz have once again accused Hamas of trying to intercept and steal and stockpile aid coming into Gaza, after vision emerged of armed men jumping on trucks driving into the strip. Hamas has rejected the allegations, saying it's Palestinian families and clans taking matters into their own hands, trying to secure the convoys to make sure aid gets to where it needs to go. The Israeli government has given the military until the weekend to come up with a new plan to keep Hamas away from the convoys. Maya Al-Aja's mother, Asma, has one message for Israel.
She doesn't need complex treatment. She just needs to eat.
A simple plea for survival. This is Matthew Doran in Tel Aviv, reporting for AM.
Meanwhile, Palestinians living on the occupied West Bank have also endured difficult conditions as Iranian and Israeli missiles exploded over their heads, showering their homes and businesses with debris and triggering fires. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
As Iranian missiles headed towards Israel, parts of them were falling from the sky in the occupied West Bank. Israeli interceptors were striking the missiles as they passed over, causing more than 200 pieces of shrapnel and debris to crash onto Palestinian towns and villages. An 11-metre section of missile fell onto Ra'ed Ahmad Robe's house in the northern West Bank.
I got a call saying a missile had struck my house. I was terrified. This is a home built over many years, and seeing it hit like that was devastating.
The Palestinian Authority says eight people, mainly children, were injured in the West Bank by missile debris. Ziad Abu Aqub's son had a lucky escape when a piece of missile fell on the street near him.
He says he felt he was in danger, and then the largest part of the missile landed and just missed him. It could have killed him. It fell at the same place where he was.
The debris also released chemicals, strange liquids and gases that Palestinians fear could be dangerous. A 2-metre piece of missile released both gas and liquid when it fell in the small village of Deir Sudan, leaving stains from unknown liquids on the ground. Village Mayor Sufyan Suleiman says residents fear being exposed to this material.
It released a substance that could be dangerous, potentially poisonous to people. If any resident had been inside their homes at the time, they could have been injured or even killed.
Israel's government says around 550 missiles were fired by Iran during the war, with most of them intercepted by the country's sophisticated air defences. The interceptors were also shooting down debris above Israeli cities, ensuring it didn't fall on homes. But the Palestinian Authority says debris fell on 35 homes and 3 factories in the West Bank, as well as starting 2 bushfires. Father Ziad Abu Aqub says Palestinians feel the Israeli military is putting them in danger.
Israel couldn't care less about our safety. The fact is that their intercept missiles fly over our villages. They damage our land, our livelihood, our main squares and our schools. It's really dangerous.
The Israeli military is yet to respond to the ABC's questions about its interceptions over the West Bank. Most Israelis have access to bomb shelters or reinforced rooms in their homes, something Palestinians do not.
Eric Torchek reporting. The ABC has found 10 families have engaged in separate legal action against a prestigious regional Victorian school over alleged abuse dating back to the 1970s. Families say peer-on-peer abuse included whippings, being forced to fight, and a culture of cruelty that led to decades of hazing. Eden Heinen reports.
These parents don't want to use their real names to protect their son's identity. I'll call them Louise and Michael. They paid more than $50,000 a year to give their teenage son the best chance at life at an elite regional boarding school, Ballarat Grammar. They say what they got was a nightmare.
A count of 150 to maybe 200 strappings for the 2 years he'd been there. He'd been burnt on his knee by a warmed up broken coat hanger. He'd been thrown into ice cold showers.
Louise and Michael say their son was subjected to constant abuse and violence from other students over the 2 years he was a boarder. He left the school.
The boy we sent to Ballarat Grammar boarding is not the boy we've got back, and they should be ashamed of it.
They allege the worst incident was in December last year at a lake in Ballarat.
He was woken up at 3:30 in the morning to four straps to his back, rolled over, Worcestershire sauce was shoved down his throat. They were told to swim the lake. Then they were given a can of dog food to eat and then sour milk. Then they were told to pair up and crab fight amongst the mud and the then vomit.
The ABC has spoken to a dozen families who allege their sons were subjected to extreme physical punishments at the boarding school over the past 3 years. 10 families are taking legal action against Ballarat Grammar. Amity Latham removed her son from the boarding school this year and is still dealing with the consequences. She says she's racked up thousands of kilometres travelling from her rural property to get him specialist care.
When we hear words, the effect that the whole school just wants to move on, I'm afraid that just isn't a reality for a family like ours.
Last week, Ballarat Grammar launched its third internal investigation in 5 months. This latest probe is into allegations of further serious misconduct in its boys' boarding houses. In a statement, Ballarat Grammar told the ABC it's already taken action, including enhanced training for staff, cultural education for students, an upgraded security infrastructure, which includes CCTV cameras, and nightly patrols by a security guard. This mother says it's simply too little too late.
They now have security in the hallways. They now have security outside. And where was it when our boys were there?
A police investigation into abuse at the school in 2023 and 2024 is underway. Victoria's Education Minister says bullying and disrespectful behaviour is unacceptable in any Victorian school. The minister did not answer questions about whether broader policy changes and oversight are needed for independent schools.
Eden Heinen with that report. Couples seeking the help of a surrogate to have a child of their own are increasingly going overseas and paying third parties to carry the baby. But with a review currently looking at whether commercial surrogacy should be allowed in Australia, advocates argue it would make a difficult and often costly process easier on all involved. But the changes are being opposed by those who want to see a ban maintained, who arguing it would only lead to exploitation. Shannon Schubert reports.
For Daniel and Michael Montgomery Morgan, becoming parents was a challenging process that took years, cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and even involved a trip to Canada.
Kind of really questioned whether we're meant to be parents. You know, when we started this process, I don't think we expected it would take us 4 years to have Spencer in our arms.
Daniel says they are now in love with their seven-month-old daughter, Spencer.
Can you say...
The Melbourne couple initially looked for a surrogate in Australia, but when they weren't able to find one and realised the limitations of Australia's surrogacy laws, they had to go abroad. But Michael says the challenges didn't stop there.
We had a surrogate and unfortunately we had 3 failed transfers. So that meant we were kind of back at square one. I think some of the frustration is that we're on the other side of the world.
In Australia, commercial surrogacy is illegal, which means surrogates can't get paid. It's one of the reasons a growing number of couples are going overseas to find one. According to the Australia and New Zealand Assisted Reproduction Database, there are around 130 babies born through a surrogate every year across Australia and New Zealand. Nearly triple that number are born via overseas surrogates for Australian couples.
I think uniform laws is really crucial for making it more accessible, but also making sure that we don't have medical tourism within our own country.
That's commercial surrogacy lawyer Sarah Jefford, who has also been a surrogate herself. She says surrogates deserve to get paid, which would lead to more people putting their hands up to be one.
We know that the fertility industry makes a lot of money in surrogacy and everybody else is paid, including the lawyers and the counsellors and the clinicians. I wonder why the surrogates have to do all of the work and take most of the risk without being compensated.
But some researchers and legal groups say commercial surrogacy should stay banned in Australia as it's unethical. They say it would inevitably lead to vulnerable women being exploited.
It's like slavery, that it's wrong to buy a person and then use them.
That's Margaret Somerville, a professor of bioethics and law at the University of Notre Dame. She says examples of exploitation overseas, including in India and Thailand, show what could happen if surrogacy is commercialised in Australia.
The women who do surrogacy, who become a surrogate, they do it because they need the money.
The Australian Law Reform Commission is reviewing the country's patchwork surrogacy laws and will consider if commercial surrogacy should be allowed in Australia. It's taking public submissions until mid-July and the final report will be handed to government mid-next year.
Shannon Sherbert. As the influence of African players continues to grow in the AFL, a rising contingent of Ghanaian Australians is making its mark, and in what is a predominantly white sport. There are four current players with Ghanaian heritage, and they've been developing their cultural identity while building a community both inside and outside the game. Pakua Frimpong reports.
Quainor's kick was absolutely perfect.
Collingwood's Isaac Quainor was the first Ghanaian to play in the AFL.
To see so many multicultural players throughout the league is awesome. But, you know, obviously being Ghanaian, they have a lot of pride with that as well.
He's been followed by Greater Western Sydney's Connor Ryden, Fremantle's Brandon Walker and Sydney's Joel Amati.
Joel Amati is having some party.
They each have one parent from Ghana and have carved their own distinct paths in the AFL. Quainor has experienced the ebbs and flows of growing up biracial in Australia.
When I'm here, I'm the black guy. When I'm there, I'm the white person. It's just a weird dynamic, but I guess it's unique and there's also a lot of good to it as well.
Well read. Howe down to half forward tonight and intercepts.
He's a good player, this bloke.
For Ryden, discovering his cultural heritage has been an ongoing process, but one that has progressed more in recent years.
At times it was, I guess you could say, a tiny bit embarrassing, like I didn't know my heritage and I wasn't able to be proud of where I came from, but that's what makes this journey so special. I have a Ghanaian middle name, Kwamina, which I sort of never really said, like I just kind of Joshua Ayden, but now I'm very proud to, you know, be kind of Joshua Kwamina Ayden.
Amati maybe for four in the quarter, high kick towards goal. He is single-handedly turning this game around.
Amati's now a key member of the Swans forward line. His dad wasn't initially thrilled with his choice of sport, though.
Yeah, I don't think he talked to me for about two months when I decided to, when I outgrew soccer, got a little bit too big in the middle of my teens. But my dad was a really good soccer player in his right. He played for the professional league in Ghana growing up, so he was very adamant that I played soccer all growing up.
The AFL's Next Gen Academy, a pathway program for Indigenous and multicultural boys, has served as a gateway into the competition for Quainor, Amati and Walker.
It makes little kids that are from different countries just think like, oh, you know, if they can do it, we can do it as well. And yeah, it's just seeing smiles on their faces.
Ayden says the support of his teammates has been crucial in his cultural journey.
You know, Toby Green's always wearing the Ghanaian soccer jersey from the World Cup a couple years ago, which is great, and getting some Ghanaian budgies made up and things like that for the boys.
While players like Alir Alir, who has South Sudanese heritage, open the door for Africans in the league, Quainor and Amati want to build on that legacy.
I'd love to be able to take, you know, some footies over and do some stuff over in different African countries, and Ghana being one of them.
What all the Indigenous boys do with their culture and their heritage and the way they grow up and how they've come together, and obviously there's so many of them, and thing as African sort of players, we look to those guys and see what they've sort of done for their people and stuff, and think we can do the same for us.
AFL player Joel Amati ending that report by Pakua Frimpong, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Nick Grimm.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump was elected on the promise of putting America first and staying out of foreign conflicts. So the US president's decision to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities caused the first and very public split among his Make America Great Again base. Today, senior political correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Molly Ball, on the fighting MAGA factions. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.